Welcome to the Great Base Tennis Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Fitzell, alongside Steve Smith. As always, welcome to episode number 9. And tonight we're going to be interviewing Miran Mann.
Miran Mann, we'll get him on the phone here momentarily. A friend from the Great White North. Maybe we should sing the Canadian national anthem.
You've done that a little bit. My home and native land.
True patriot love.
It's not bad.
So we need to interview some briefcase pros, but from the trenches, we're going to talk to Miran Mann, a ball hopper guy.
Yeah.
We're going to have a two-part series. He works with Richard Hernandez. So Miran is the young guy. We'll go with the first version of the young guy. Miran, we're going to ask him questions about his career and also tennis in Canada. So I'd say that goes back 20 years. And then the old man, Richard, will get him on the phone, and that's pre-internet. That's going back
old man Richard.
Yeah, old man Richard. So let's get the Canadian boy on the phone.
All right, let's do it.
One ring.
Hello?
Miran.
Good evening. Andy, what's up?
Welcome to the Great Base Tennis Podcast. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Miran.
Thanks for having me. Thanksgiving Monday here in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, my sister sent me a reminder today that it's Thanksgiving in Canada. With where to start? Tennis-wise, you hear this question quite often. What's going on in Canada? Did they put something in the water? John McEnroe. I can accept Canada having better hockey players than the United States. But I cannot accept Canada having better tennis players than the United States. But Miran, let's go through your story. Born in South Africa. Why don't you tell us, the listeners, a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I was born in South Africa. Family moved to Boston for a year. My dad was studying to be an accountant, or had to get a degree to be an optometrist in Canada. So once moved from Boston, moved to Thornhill, which is a suburb of Toronto. It's just outside Toronto. And then kind of grew up playing tennis out of Richmond Hill Country Club under Richard Hernandez. And then I think when I was about 11 or 12, I think, Steve, you came around that time, around 11 or 12 years old.
I was playing under you for two years there. My two boys were playing in ice hockey. Toronto, what a great place to be based out of if your kids are playing ice hockey. Keep going. 84, yeah. Born in 1984.
So then played there, and then kind of was a pretty good junior, you know, won doubles nationals, maybe like top five in Canada, and then ended up going to the U.S. on a scholarship at University of Utah. Played top of the lineup there primarily, and played usually one doubles there for 5 years. And then kind of when I finished graduating from Utah, I came back to Toronto and I wanted to get involved with coaching. And then Richard recommended that I go do a 6-month internship under you. So that's kind of where my coaching career started.
Life-changing experience.
That was
definitely a life-changing experience coming from college. Those are some long days.
Those are some light days, I would thought.
Especially college in Utah. I mean, come on.
Well, I can actually go back. I like to tell people I have total recall. I recall totally what I want to. But when you showed up, David Squire was there, and he brought his son, and there was a few beers. Christian Lynch was there as well.
I think Andy was there too, actually. No, that's the first time I showed up.
Yeah, I think 2008, right?
Yeah, I think you were there with Morgad as well.
Yep.
Jim Morgad, like, yeah.
Yep.
Doing that workshop. Yeah, Andy, after winter break.
Yeah, Andy was there to do a workshop. But Christian Lynch, so those two Aussies, I remember when you first came in, they did a lot of 12-ounce curls. So your first few days, or maybe even a better part of a week, I just thought that was so funny when you showed up from college to do an internship, that we had the Aussies there that were drinking mother's milk. They brought, I know Henry Squire, David's son, he's doing quite well now. I think his first trip to see us,
Good times.
Yeah, with, But there's so many things that we could talk about. When you went back to Canada and you started your coaching career, tell us a little bit about the big three, Felix, Bianca, and Dennis. I know that you did some work with Tennis Canada. Didn't you actually get an award for being a young upcoming coach?
Yeah. So kind of when I finished my internship there, I came back to Canada and started working at the club. And I started, I got the honor of being like a mentor coach, which is basically like a lot of young coaches were given the honor of like kind of helping out with national camp regrouping. So it's like a 3-year program, the mentorship program. So in year one, you help out with, like the national camps, which I think there was about 4 or 5 national regroupings a year. And then the second year you go on a tour with like an older coach, kind of like a mentor coach. And then the third year you help lead a tour by yourself. So I did that for 3 years, as a mentor coach while working out of the club. But, you know, luckily enough, I remember to this day, the initial national camp that I did, the national regrouping, I remember Bianca must have been 9 years old, hit the ball well, you know, had out of all the girls there, she had the cleanest strokes, technically ground strokes. But she was by far the worst in terms of results, resume at that time. She was by far the worst. There was another girl, Maria Tinasescu, who now plays out of the club sometimes, who was much better than her and I think was an under 12 national champion. I think at that time, Bianca was one of the worst. So I would have never known that she would have become who she's become, but it was like to think about who was at this camp. And then you had Felix was at the camp with the boys. Dennis was at the camp with the boys. There was another boy, his name was Tabilo, who ended up, making second round of Aussie Open this year. But I think it's lucky enough with the boys, at least, you know, it was probably one of the best generation of kids that Canada's had in, I would say forever. So, you know, Felix was never always the best. Dennis was definitely never the best. You know, we know Dylan Bondarchuk was involved. There were so many others. It was a group of about 10 to 12 that were always kind of pushing each other until the age of maybe 13, 14. And then you started to see a little bit of separation.
What did you remember about them as juniors? Was there anything, though, that stood out? Like you were saying with Bianca, she had the best ground strokes or the cleanest ground strokes. Yeah. Was there anything with Felix or Dennis or...
So with Felix, like I took him on a tour to Italy for 3 weeks. So I was with him like day in, day out. Mm-hmm.
And how old was he then?
He was 12 years old.
Okay.
And he was extremely organized, like backpack, literally behaved like he was an 18, 19 year old, like when he was 12, like so mature. So organized, so professional, just in the way he prepared for matches and the way he finished matches. So like you never had to tell him to go to the weight room after a match and, you know, go through your cool down routine, go through a warm up. Never, right. Never once did I ever have to tell him anything about that. It was just kind of like, this is what I'm going to do. This is kind of automatic for me. In terms of coaching Felix, he was extremely stubborn. Extremely at the time. Like I was with him for 3 weeks and for the first 2 weeks, he didn't want to hear one word from me. So it took him about 2 weeks to actually even for me to even like break the ice and for him to actually be receptive to kind of anything I would say to him. And it wasn't a lot, a small tip here or there, right?
Yeah.
So there was another coach, Andre Labelle, who did the trip with me, who's kind of been involved with Tennis Canada for a long time, and he kind of had a big influence with Bianca and also Felix. So I think, you know, Felix probably felt more comfortable with him. So that's kind of what I remember with Felix, but just maturity. And he was always really good. Like from the age of 10, 11, 12, I remember him playing under 12 nationals. He was fearless.
Yeah.
Like he's playing under 12 nationals, not playing like Mickey Mouse tennis. He was cracking the ball from day one. He would never play different based on his opponent, which is kind of a lot of times what you see in junior tennis. You know, you're the favorite. You play slow. Maybe you moonball. You get tight. Where Felix just kind of had his identity and established his identity. If he won, he won. If he lost, he lost. And he always behaved kind of mature like that.
Years later, I was just going to say he won his first match in a challenger. I'm pretty sure he was only 14.
Yeah, 2 years later, 14 in Drummondville.
Yeah, yeah. That's the beauty of YouTube. Amazing. You could watch that on YouTube.
Yeah.
Miron, that same summer that you were in Italy, I know the Canadians, typically they take the top kids at the beginning of the summer, and then they come home, they play their nationals, and then they go back to Europe and play at the end of the summer. So I had seen him that summer. Our listeners should also know that I periodically will have Miron talk to juniors about experiences such as being with Felix, or I mean, obviously you can talk in more length about Dennis. But why don't you tell us about Felix when you know you tell a story about he was in Quebec and how old young he was going on the train to Montreal. I know that it's a lot safer in Canada. I mean, your population base is 10% of what ours is here in the U.S. But why don't you tell a little bit about that story, that part of the story?
Yeah, so Felix's dad, Sam. Sam is the head pro at the biggest club in Quebec City, and Quebec City is quite far from Montreal. It's about off the top of my head, I'd say it's a 2 to 4 hour drive. So when Felix was younger, you know, his parents got divorced, and Sam was working out of Quebec City. So during the week, when Felix was about 10 years old, he would train with his dad Monday to Thursday, and then he would hop on the train on Thursday night to get to Montreal and train at the National Center for the weekend. And then he would take a train back to go to his dad to be back in Quebec City on Monday. And he did that for an entire year. And I know Tennis Canada wanted him at the time to move to Montreal full time, but I guess it was kind of the agreement that they came up with. So he was 10 or 11 years old, and he was traveling weekly back and forth on a train by himself.
Yeah.
It shows the maturity.
With like so many marriages, his parents, they ended up getting divorced. Why don't you tell that story about when the parents sat him down with his sister?
Yeah, so Sam was telling me, and I sat with Sam one day at the club for a lot of hours, and I just kind of picked his brain just about Felix, because I told him that I took Felix to Italy. And he was telling me that, you know, Felix was about 7 or 8 years old when his parents got a divorce, and, you know, Sam and his ex-wife sat Felix and Felix's sister down. I believe her name's Malika. She was 2 years older, and, you know, they sat the kids down, and they said, you know, guys, unfortunately our marriage isn't working out, but we're going to have to get a divorce. And, the sister started crying and obviously became visibly upset. And Felix, in a stone face with no emotion, just said, whatever happens between you and mom is your business. As long as you guys can get me to my tennis, everything's okay. And the dad was looking at me and was like, he's been wanting to be a pro, you know.
Wow.
He's had a dream. Like, the dad was telling me when Felix was about 5 or 6 years old, he talked about wanting to win the French Open. And the dad told him, you know, well, you got to work hard. You got to work hard. You got to work hard. And the next day, Felix was in the house running laps in the morning around the court, telling dad he's ready for the French Open. Huh. But the dad comes from Africa, immigrant family. I think he built up a pretty good academy in Quebec City, but I think it must have been tough, you know? So there's definitely some background there.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's moved into the top 20 in the world, hasn't he? 17 in the world, I think.
I think currently I'm looking at the rankings now. He's 22 in the world.
And he's how old?
He's 20. He's a year younger than Dennis. So there was another boy named Nikias who ended up going to Tennessee and then transferred to Liberty recently. But Nikias and Felix were the same age growing up, and they were both looked at as being kind of special. Like when I went to Italy, I took both of them to Italy. But Nikias and Felix up at, you know, in the 12s, they were 50-50 on who would win. And then even in the first year 14, they're about 50-50. And then suddenly Felix turned 14 and it was just like, bye-bye Nikias. And Nikias, when he was 12, was, you know, they thought he was going to be as good as Felix. Like, I think he won a big international tournament. I know Felix won that big international under 12 tournament, Tarps, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And Nikias might have been a fine, and Nikias did well there too. Like, they were both best in the world, or one of the best in the world in 12s for sure.
But Dennis, why don't you tell the listeners, Richard Hernandez, we really haven't said that much about the Richmond Hill Country Club. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke to Dave Anderson, who's at the Brookhaven Country Club. And I think one similarity between both places is that both are amazing facilities, but you don't really get the feel tennis-wise that you're at a country club. But Dennis, his mother was hired, I think, when Dennis was like 3 years old, and Tesla worked 10 years, under Richard at the Richmond Hill Country Club. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Dennis?
Yeah, so I think Tessa, most of Tessa's time that she worked there was like when I was kind of finishing my junior career and then went to college. So I was basically like kind of out of the loop of the club for a bit. But my memories of Dennis are, you know, like I came back from my internship with you, Steve, and, you know, that summer I was helping out running the camp. So I would run the summer camp with Dennis, and we had a big group of, say, I don't know, 20 kids or something. And then the camp would be like a 9-to-4 camp, and practice would finish, and Tessa would ask me to hit with Dennis. And I'd be, sure, yeah, I'll work with Dennis. So I would work with Dennis for like an hour and a half almost every day after practice. And I would ask Tessa, you know, what do you want me to do specifically with Dennis? And Tessa would say, you know, I want you to hit the ball as heavy and as hard as you can to his back end for an hour and a half. And this was on clay. This was on at Richmond Hill Country Club. We have 11 outdoor clay courts. So for an hour and a half, I'm just hitting heavy to this guy's back end. And his dad, Victor, would watch every single practice, and Dennis would be whining and, you know, complaining and crying. And I would, you know, I try to say help him a little bit, but he's like 8 years old and things like jumping over his shoulders. And
that's what I was going to
ask.
Like
8 or 9 years old, and things like jumping over his shoulders, and he's shanking everywhere. And but I just kept on going, and you know, I think, you know. That was kind of my first memory of him, but he always carried himself like he wanted to be a pro, like put his headband on like he does now, you know.
Yeah.
Be like, went about his warm up like he wanted to be a pro, I know he put in a ton of time on the court, like a ton, like he lived on the court,
He always wanted to be a one hander. Is that right?
Yeah, he was a one hander from day one, and. He was fearless from day one. Like I would take him, I remember doing like inter-county, which is like kind of like club league matches here, but the level's not very good. It's more on the rec side. And I remember going to, I think I went to Newmarket where Brian Drexel's at. And I remember taking Dennis there, and Dennis was about 8 or 9 years old, and he was playing against like 18-year-old boys. And he was like beating them, or like coming close to beating them. It was a little rec league, but he was fearless against those guys. You know, he would just act like he acted, and he would cry and he would complain when he lost, and his attitude was terrible. But he would never quit. You know, he would just be like a big baby, and then he would kind of like find a way to compete. So,
how old was he when
emotionally he was a baby?
I was just going to ask, how old was he when he started? Do you know? 2, 3,
when he was
4.
Born.
Yeah.
So no, I don't know.
Came out of the womb.
He came out of the womb. I think his mom gave him a racket. Well, the funny thing is his brother is not very athletic. So I think his brother, Eugene, is very smart. He's on the intellectual. I think he's like a computer science. He's into like computers and IT, and he's very smart. And he had more of the dad's gene. Victor's a kind of bigger, bulkier guy, where Dennis is more on the mom's team. But I think Tessa was, she might have been like top 300 in the world. So she was a pretty good player. And she's a tall woman, lanky, so like a good tennis body. And Dennis has more of the mom's type of body than the dad.
With Dennis, you said winning wasn't, obviously, he wanted to be a tennis player, but the mother was not so much interested in winning, where they would skip nationals or, you know, evaluate, well, we can't go all the way up to Vancouver. She knew the levels. Why don't you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, like a lot of the time, you know, like kind of Tennis Canada would make, so if you kind of wanted to go on tours in the summer, you know, sometimes Tennis Canada would say, well, you have to go play this nationals. And if you play this nationals, then you'll get an opportunity to go on this tour in the summer. But, you know, from Tessa's point of view, she looked at it as being like, well, I'm not going to spend, because nationals was, I was a provincial coach for Ontario. So I would take lead like Team Ontario to go to nationals. And I think I did it for about 4 or 5 years in Vancouver. So it was a long way away. Like Vancouver to Toronto was the same distance as like, I don't know, Miami to like California. Like it's a long way. So It's a lot of money. So Tessa, you know, whenever it happened, Tessa never sent him to those nationals in the West Coast. And he just played up a lot. And, you know, he'd go to the nationals when it was in Quebec or Ontario, but I don't think he ever came to a West Coast nationals ever. And the mom, you know, the mom wasn't concerned with, you know, and at 12 years old, Dylan Bondarczyk was beating Dennis every single time. I remember Dylan Bondarczyk was just beating Dennis every single time. And I remember one day when Dennis was about 14 or 15, I remember go watching Dennis play Bondarczyk at ORC Racquet Club, which is about a 20, 30 minute drive from Richmond Hill. And I remember Dennis beat Bondarczyk like 1-1. And it was like a beatdown. And I was like, holy this guy's good. Then I was like, holy this guy's good.
Well, that left to serve.
Like, that was like two or three years after Dylan was beating him almost every time.
For our listeners, Dylan Bondarczyk, he was 5 years old. They were hitting balls in Clearwater Beach. And one of my friends was just jogging by and stopped to talk to these people about tennis. I think it was, you know, Christmas Eve or whatever. So it might have been Christmas Day if they were hitting tennis balls. So my friend said, you should come now, go over to Tampa. So they did. And next thing I know, that was Christmas time. But the dad brought him back for the entire summer. So, I mean, I spent so much time. I have so much film of Dylan. And, he became the best player in Canada in the 10s, 12s. You know, obviously he was right up there in the 14s. I asked Dylan a year ago, because I know he was beating him breadsticks and bagels. I said, what happened? Mm-hmm. And he said, I got cocky. And, but Dylan was a lefty also, very competitive. But that's interesting. So Tessa, she worked 10 years with you on the staff at Richmond Hill. Then she moved on where she could have more court time, set up a warehouse. Tell us about the young man. Yeah. I've never met him. Is it Adrian? Adrian?
So Adriano Fuberia is his name. So I think he was like kind of working at a Veneto Tennis Club for a while, just coaching there. He was involved with like Tennis Canada, but not on the coaching side, more on like the tournament side. But kind of had a passion for tennis. And I guess when Dennis was about 13 or 14, I think Tessa took over a warehouse and she built two courts in an industrial area close to Richmond Hill, but in an industrial area to basically give Dennis more court time. And during that time, Adriana was basically kind of took over as being like Dennis's primary coach. Obviously, Tessa always had say, and Tessa was always kind of the boss. But Adriana was, because I think Tessa needed to make money and she was running her academy to basically support everything Dennis needed. So Adriana was kind of there, just doing everything for Dennis, from traveling with him to training with him to taking him to tournaments. But I remember a story that Adriano told me, where Adriano would go and practice serves with Dennis in Tessa's indoor facility. And Adriano would always talk about, you know, hitting serves and not where the serve bounced in the box, but like the outcome of where the ball ends up. So he would basically put a mark on the wall and he'd be like, all right, Dennis, you have to make this many serves on the wall before we got to go home. And he said he would go practice serves with Dennis at like 1 or 2 in the morning at Tessa's facility. And Dennis would be like crying and whining and complaining. And Adrian was like, all right, we'll keep complaining, but we're not going home until you finish. And that happened often. But I think Adriano played a huge role in Dennis from a mental perspective, like just maturing and becoming, a man, because I think, you know, I remember my memory of Dennis was he was young, immature, and behavior was not that good. But I think he was around Adriano a lot, like Adriano would travel with him everywhere. Every tournament, Adriano would go with him. So,
well, when you read about great tennis players, a lot of times it's like a horse. They say the one that's most difficult to break can run the fastest.
I was going to ask you, Miran, do you remember from Dennis? I mean, I've seen video of him on YouTube when he's like 8 years old and he was, you know, attacking going forward. Do you remember that they kind of wanted him to be an all court player or just?
Oh yeah. Yeah. From day one, that kid was, he was going to be an all court player.
Yeah.
He was going to go forward. He was going to be aggressive. I remember watching him play under 14 nationals and he was 12. And he was controlling matches against 14-year-olds. Like he was always
the aggressor.
He was always encouraged. He was always encouraged to play first strike tennis.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story. I took Dennis to, I was an assistant coach at Junior Davis Cup qualies in Montreal 1 year. And the team was, I think it was Dennis, Felix, and Dennis, this kid, Benjamin Seguin, and Jack Minji Lin. So Gwyn played at UNC and Minji Lin, I think, went to Columbia. Anyway, Dennis played a boy named Nathan Ponowitz. You guys might have heard of him. I think he went to Georgia. Mm. Dennis lost to Ponowitz 1-1 or 1-2. And if Ponowitz put 3 balls in play, Ponowitz would win the point. But right. Dennis is just trying to play offense on everything. Like, you know, he might have made 60 unforced errors that match. Like, just like, you know, if Ponowitz could put one extra ball in play, like I say, Ponowitz put 3 balls in play, Dennis would miss.
Yeah.
And that was, and then about 8 months later, Dennis went on a crazy streak. He won like 3 futures in a row down in Florida coming from qualies. So he went like, and those quality futures, I think they're around December time. Those are like big draw qualies.
Yeah.
I think they're like
128
draw qualies.
Yeah.
And he went through like 3 in a row to win. And that was like 8 months later. And like 4 months later than that, he beat Tom with like 1-1. So like he was playing first strike aggressive tennis from forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
Oh, that's
but winning was never an emphasis at 12. Never. I think that's kind of the mom saw the big picture in that, you know.
It sounds like the mother certainly, and the father. We use, as you know, the term PPP, parental permission for pounding. But you know, when you hear, you know, how a kid becomes emotional so many times, it's because they're so driven. They want to be a player so badly. There's a YouTube clip. You're court 19 and court 20 at the Richmond Hill Country Club.
Forehand swings a little big. I mean, baggy shorts.
Yeah.
It's a fun clip. It's a fun clip.
Well, I think one thing too is that his process has been so accelerated. I think people need to understand that, you know, Richard tells me that if someone were to go to Tessa's place, that, you know, the beginners are being taught the same way they were when she was at the staff. Or on the staff at Richmond Hill. But I do remember being on conference calls where every so often Richard would call and I would talk to everybody on the staff. And there were certain things that were not accepted by Tessa, like, say, for example, a continental grip on the forehand volley. But definitely, for the most part, the story that you and Richard tell us that, you know, he definitely was in the system working on fundamentals. With also too is that all the years that, you know, she was on staff, parents couldn't teach their own children. Is that correct? Within group lessons?
Yeah. Well, I think it got to the point where Tessa was wouldn't even do anything, you know, like her eyes were basically on Dennis and only Dennis. So I think Richard had to implement that rule where parents couldn't teach classes with their children in it because it just got too much and the other kids weren't getting enough attention. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what happened in that regard. But even before me, I think Mario Cosentino would help teach, would teach Dennis a lot.
No, Richard has told Mario me. That, go ahead. Sorry.
And Mario would even go and play practice matches with Dennis when Dennis was like 14, 15, 16. Like Dennis would play, I think Adriana did a great job of that. Like Dennis would play, you know, there's like these Sunday night leagues, like these major leagues, these doubles leagues. I don't know if you remember that, but
Oh, yeah.
We have like doubles leagues here. They're like majors leagues, which is like kind of the top level. And it was all about all older men playing it, mostly like guys who graduated from college and, you know, are playing it. And Dennis would always play for Veneto, like always. And he would play with Mario a lot.
No, I have in my notes Mario Cosentino, who I also, you know, coached, not only during the visits, but the 2 years, I think 95 to 97. He's a year older than you, correct, Mario?
Yeah, a year older.
But I tell the story with you and Mario often because you guys would do our tiebreaker test, too, on your own. Where you get out on the clay courts, maybe on the indoor courts, you would just put down some skip ropes between the baseline and the service line. And you got to hit those first three shots over the, say, on the clay court, you draw a line in the dirt. But Mario hit a really clean tennis ball with, remember?
Yeah, it still does.
It's just brain memory. You can roll out of bed and hit the ball well. Let's move on. Want to tell us a few things about Bianca. I know she was born in Canada, went back to Romania. Her father's good friend was a teaching pro, and she pretty much modeled her game after Simona Halep. Also, I think another thing is we'll talk to Richard. Richard, besides being the director of tennis at the Richmond Hill Country Club, he actually has 10 grass courts. He has a place out in the country. So through that setup he has, which is very unique, he gets to see these top Canadian kids want to, you know, jump on the grass before they go overseas. But what comes to your mind with Bianca?
Yeah, I just have one story. You know, I remember this was even last year. So last year she won the U.S. Open and she stopped by the club. I don't know why she was at the club. I think she's good friends with the girl I grew up teaching, Laura Creve. I think they're like best friends. And there's a big Romanian community in that. Especially in tennis in Toronto, like tons. Romanians love tennis. Anyways, Bianca stopped by the club. She was training at the club. I think she needed to use the club to train and she was doing fitness and stuff. And we just asked her if she doesn't mind coming on the court and just talking to the kids. So one of the kids asked her a question like, you know, what inspires you in tennis? And her message to the kid was, I want to leave a legacy in tennis. I want to be remembered as a great tennis player, leaving a lasting legacy. Like, holy crap. Like, you know, you're looking at this girl, she's like 18 years old and she's saying that. You're like, oh my God. I think she's just so mature. So mature.
Oh, we'd say,
she had a lot of, you know, I think she was given a lot of private attention. Like, she went through multiple stress fractures when she was like 15, 16 in her foot. And I remember watching her and the coach, Andre Lebel, she would be sitting on a bench and Andre Lebel would be feeding her balls. And she would just be like sitting in a bench for hours.
And no, she would no whining there.
Because of her stress fracture.
Well,
and
you know,
she would just be hitting balls in the bench, in the chair, and serving. And like doing, just keep playing tennis even when she was, couldn't move, right?
Yeah. Thomas Muster.
Amazing.
Coming back to the top.
Yeah, exactly. It reminds me of that Muster clip.
Yeah.
He was curbside and a drunk driver hit him, and he, a couple days later, built a chair.
Yeah.
But coming back to the top of the hour, we talked, you know, what's going on in Canadian tennis. All three of these players really had a different path where Dennis elected not to work with Tennis Canada, just worked privately with what his mother created through Richmond Hill and then her own program. With Bianca, she never left Toronto. She did do camps in Montreal, But the Tennis Canada customized a program for her. And then Felix, he eventually spent most of his time in Montreal, like 14, 15 years old, correct? So all three.
Yeah.
From the outside, people think, well, Tennis Canada, they're starting all these kids. They're all doing the same thing from the age of 8. But that's not really the case, correct?
Yeah, I would say Bianca only kind of was introduced more full-time into the Tennis Canada program when she was about 14. Dennis was never ever full-time into the Tennis Canada program, and Felix was probably the closest to being almost always involved with Tennis Canada consistently. Tennis Canada would always have these regroupings and they would take these tours. So Bianca would go on the tours in the summer to Austria. And a lot of the time we go, the young Canadians, the 12s and unders would go on tours to Europe and just play on red clay for a month. Mm. So they were all, Dennis, Bianca and Felix all were involved with those tours, and they were all involved with the national camp regroupings. But outside of those regroupings and those tours, I think Dennis was never involved with Tennis Canada, and Bianca was involved up to the age of 14. And Felix probably he was going to Tennis Canada on the train when he was 11 or 12.
How would you define the term regrouping? What does that mean?
So they were 4 or 5 day regroupings, and they did some positive things, Tennis Canada. Like the parents could not stay at the regrouping, so the parents had to drop the kids up and leave. So for example, Dennis came, I remember the first regrouping, Felix came and he was about 9 years old, and the dad basically dropped him off and said, I'll see you in 5 days. And he had to go back home with another coach. So they did positive things, but at this regrouping, you would basically, a day would be split up like this. You would do a 2 hour training session. Then you would do an hour to 2 hours of fitness. Then you would do a mental training session with a sports psychologist. Then you would do there was a physio on site, the Tennis Canada's head physio, who would basically do physio tests and test range of motions. And then it would basically be those would be the days. So there'd be double practices. So you'd be a 2 hour practice in the morning, fitness, 2 hour practice in the afternoon, some form of sports psychology, some form of physio. And then you would repeat that for 4 to 5 days. And they would just bring all the best players in the country together. Most of the time it was in Ontario.
One thing. Go ahead.
No, that was that was usually it happened at this club called the Granite Club, which had nice red clay courts. So we would usually do one regrouping at the Granite Club, and then one regrouping would be done at, I think York University, which is where the Rogers Cup is.
Yeah.
And then one regrouping would figure out the last regrouping. So there were usually 3 regroupings a year where all the best kids would come together and just practice together. And then myself, who was a mentor coach, was kind of fortunate enough to just kind of help out.
I remember being at the Granite Club with Richard Hernandez, the director wanted to just talk tennis. So we went down and, a cup of tea and a muffin, and they just pulled these curtains open, and it was a rink for figure skaters. And I had never seen a rink without hockey boards. So when you say the Granite Club. But with tennis in Canada, I think one thing that's positive that you could comment on is your national tournaments are different weeks. We're here in the U.S., all the 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s, the nationals are all the same week. So in Canada, the 12s are 1 week, and then if you do really well, you can play the 14s, correct?
Yeah. So that's usually the difference is, I think, one of the big differences is the player pool in Canada compared to the U.S. is, our national tournaments are, I think the maximum kids we have are 40, maybe 48 max. One of the positives I think that we have in our national system is at junior nationals, level, the tournaments are not usual tournaments. So basically kids get grouped into round robins. So there's 8 groups, and each group has 5 kids in it, say. So you play a ton of matches. Like, it's not like you go to a tournament sometimes for nationals and you lose first round and you're done, double crown, right, and you're done, you go home. Like, when you're going to 12 and 14s, you could leave that tournament and you could play 10, 12 matches in a week. So I think that's like a really good thing that they introduced, right? Because kids are coming from far, and, you know, if you wouldn't think about it like this, so you have to win your four matches in your group. Then you go into like a finals draw of, say, 16 people. So now you, to win the tournament, you really have to play, like, I think, 8 matches, 9 matches to win a national title.
Wow.
And even for the kids that don't win, you know, they're getting way more match play than they would get in a regular tournament.
What's becoming,
which I think is a super positive thing.
Becoming a problem here in the U.S. is parents are paying more and their child is paying less. You know, sometimes the consolations are reduced to pro sets. You know, they're not playing full 3 sets.
Yeah.
Another thing that Tennis Canada that I've been impressed by is when kids go to Europe, they can transfer points back. So an American child, for example, they would be hesitant to go to Europe to play, but say a guy wants to play Kalamazoo, a gal wants to play San Diego, and if they go to Europe, it's difficult to get into those tournaments. They're not guaranteed to get in those tournaments. I mean, I do know they'll go by ATP points and ITF points now, but I think that was always a positive as far as playing overseas. That's something that with, you know, I think we can talk more about with Richard about the history of Tennis Canada with money and how Michael Downing, who was the CEO for several years, he left for the LTA to run the British Federation. Then he came, now he's back. But they raised quite a bit of money. But also, too, when you travel, I think that's another good thing, is that they send an old coach and a young coach, correct? So you were the young coach on these trips?
Yeah, I was with Andre LaBelle. So, like, I would travel. He basically showed me the ropes and what he did. So I traveled with him for 3 weeks in Italy. And it was always like that. You're in this mentor program, and then as a mentor coach, you travel with, like, a seniority coach. But I think, you know, looking back at tennis in Canada, like, I remember when I was growing up, you know, I'm the same age as Frank Dantzovic. And, you know, Dantzovic had a pretty good career. I think, you know, his ranking, he must have been top 50 in the world at one point, or close. And when I was growing up, me and Mario Cosentino and a couple other good Canadians were growing up, you know, there was nothing for us. There was no such thing as these national camp regroupings, kids going to Europe. Like, it was either, the only person that got money was Dantzovic at that time. So these national camps were only really introduced. They were, like, put in just at the right time. Then I think what happened is these guys like Felix and Dennis, you know, they suddenly see Milos doing well.
Yeah.
And then they're going to Europe and they're doing well in these European tournaments. And they're beating, like, the best French kids or Italian kids. And I think it just created a little bit of that, like, self-belief. Where I don't think before, I just think, like, I definitely never had any opportunity to travel very much or even get to these regroupings and get the amount of opportunity that these guys were fortunate to get. So Downey definitely, you know, the amount of money that they raised to support the high-performance kid is amazing.
With there's always an exception to a rule. I have in my notes here that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I always think of Canadian tennis is being city-fied, not country-fied. In other words, tennis is pretty much only played in, you know, greater Vancouver, greater Toronto, greater Montreal. Obviously, you know, you've mentioned Quebec. I mean, so there's small pockets. But I know I did some video work for Frankie Dantzovic's father, for his son, Frankie, who, I mean, I remember he beat Roddick, and he went 3 sets with Nadal. You know, now he's in charge of the Davis Cup, but they put together.
Any coach is possible now, I think.
Is that right? He put together this small group. They put a really so Niagara Falls. For our people listeners, the American side is not as nice as the Canadian side, but in a small town, they put together an exceptional academy. And there was that young player. I did video work for him. What was Bruno's last name? He tragically died.
Gostinelli.
Yeah, he died in a motorcycle accident. Is that right?
He got the number one in the country, NCAA, played at Kentucky.
Yeah.
Cleanest one-hander ever.
No, I didn't. I mean, I remember his father, you know, just saying to me, "My son will go to the net." And I mean, I did video work for him when he was, you know, really young, but yeah, it was tragic. But I've got my
he
notes.
He was serving volley.
Yeah,
Bruno was serving volley. He was serving and volleying at 10, 11, 12,
yeah,
13, every point.
But no, it was,
every point I remember.
But no, I remember crazy. That because I did video work for the dad, and I was just pleasantly surprised that this kid was like, oh, it's, you know, they understood it wasn't the, you know, the 2-inch trophy on the weekend. But I read where in Canada, there's one indoor court per 50,000 people, and where in France, there's one indoor court per 5,000 people. But would you say that for the most part, though, it's tennis is really not, I mean, the hockey players come from all these small towns, but the tennis players, unlike a lot of places, kids will come from a small town and then they go seeking the competition to be in a different environment, to be in a city. But for the most part, tennis is just played in those three areas. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. Greater Vancouver, you've got maybe a little bit in like Calgary, Edmonton. They just built like a new, really nice facility there. And then you've got Toronto and like the greater Toronto area. And then you've got kind of Montreal. And you very rarely find kids that come from small towns because I just don't think there's indoor courts.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So you don't have any, you know, you're only playing 6 months out of the year. So wow. I think it's tough.
So indoor court time is really tough to get then.
Just say that again, Andy?
Indoor court time is just really tough to get then in general.
Oh, yeah. Like, really tough. Like, Milos would go and practice at 6 a.m. in the morning to make sure he got indoor courts when he was younger.
You know,
if you...
Go ahead.
You can't get courts from, like, 4 to 7, 4 to 8. You're not getting a court.
Well,
almost anywhere.
I was, you know, living in Canada for, I lived there for 2 years, but I certainly did a number of projects. And one time with Richard was helping him. The idea was to set up a corporate membership. And Andrew Schneider, I believe he's top 50 in the world. He had wins over top 10 players. I remember on his resume, it was a picture of him on a Canadian tennis magazine with his fists clenched. And, but Schneider and Milos Raonic, about 20 years apart, no connection, but both their fathers took a second job and they both vacuumed indoor courts at Mayfair West so their kids could hit balls before going to school. So yeah, the hungry dog hunts best. I like talking about the immigrants, but yeah, in the cold weather, getting up, the winters are long, getting up when it's dark and practicing 6 a.m. And but yeah, that Thornhill, Richmond Hill, North York, there's actually a long list of Canadians that were top 100 players. Of course, this is before the internet. I think two things that really helped is number one, as you mentioned, that inner belief system, kind of like Roger Bannister when he broke the 4-minute mile in 1954, six people broke it within the same year. You know, you can go way back to 1989. I thought it was a misprint. Get myself in trouble saying that, but when I read that Canada won the Sunshine Cup, which was played right around the same time, either right before or right after the Orange Bowl, and it was a Davis Cup format. There was the Continental Cup. That was the version of the girls' version of the Federation Cup. But Daniel Nestor, I got it down here, Robert Janicek, Greg Ozeski, Sebastian LeBlanc, that was an amazing group. Mm. But they beat Sweden. Nestor won one of those matches 1-0, and 3 years later he beat Edberg. So I think some of those things always help out. But I think with, like a Jeannie Bouchard winning Wimbledon juniors in 2012 and then 2016, Dennis wins it, that the thinking went from being a top 100 player to being a top 10 player. So I think the Canadians, they've lost that inferiority complex. They've always had a superiority complex in hockey. Even when they lose some world championship, they lose. You know, they
don't deserve to lose.
They're still the best. arguably, they are the best. But but I think that whole way of thinking really changed with the junior Grand Slams. What else, Andy? The immigrants, hungry dog hunts best.
No, I was just going to say with the indoor court time, that makes sense. I mean, living in Germany for the last 4 years, court time in the wintertime was, you know, it's available, it's there, but it's expensive. My wife and I would play, you know, just for fun once a week, but we had to prepay for the court for the whole season. And, you know, it's like 20 or 25 euros an hour. But I just remember, you know, it was like, it's pretty full. The halls are all pretty full. So it was like, okay, if our court was at 9 o'clock, it was like you were there beforehand, you were warmed up, you were stretched. And then the minute you got on the court, it was like, you know, doing the Jim Verdick warm up, or just you try to hit as many balls as possible. You really maximize your time for that 1 hour. And I think that's probably true in those, all those, you know, Eastern European countries where it's really cold, court time is scarce. And then obviously in Canada, it's the same thing where when you do get a court hour, you're going to maximize it.
Well, it's interesting. The best tennis players in Florida are not from Florida. There's exceptions like a Chrissy Everett, a Jim Courier, but most people move to Florida. If you're a snowbird, say from Toronto, and you come to Florida for a spring break,
yeah,
you want to go to the beach. But if you live in Florida, you're going to put it off, and the year goes by, and you may have not gone to the beach one time.
Right.
I always tease our listeners. I tease Miron. He's born in South Africa, so I call him a paper Canadian. Such a beautiful country. There's a lot of people that would love to live in Canada. You can go to junior tournament. I tease people. I said, you know, are there any Canadians here? Because it's amazing how many immigrants. And it's true in this country. I mean, Andre Agassi, Pete Sampras, and Michael Chang. I mean, you could say Federer is his mother, is his wife. So when people come to a new country, they have to learn a new language and find a new way. But I also think, too, in Canada, among the Eastern Europeans especially, tennis is just a highly regarded sport, correct? It's like top of the list.
Yeah, for sure. I think you know, like if you take a Canadian and you ask them to rank tennis as their sport, like it might be 20th, 25th on their list, right? But if you go look at it, if you go to a local tennis tournament, just an Ontario tennis tournament, and you just look at the draw, like you won't see, you might see one actual Canadian name. Like you're, it's all Serbian, Slovakian, Romanian, tons, like just so European. And I think, you know, if you ask them to name their favorite sport, their tennis is one or two. And so, like, you know, now they're, you know, those kids who before would be playing other sports are now playing tennis. So you're getting probably better athletes playing tennis because their families like tennis.
Yeah, I think being in Canada, you're much more apt to see a pickup soccer game in Canada than you would in the U.S. Tell us about, I've got a lot of things written down with Richard Hernandez from a tennis teaching standpoint, you know, going back to, you know, Peter Burwash or Louis Caillé with the action method, you know, the things with Bob Brad and Luis Borfiga, the gentleman from the French Tennis Federation. But how about when you started your career, how about with, tell our listeners about, you know, being certified tennis pro in Canada, being licensed, how's that work out?
Right. So, you know, I was fortunate enough that when I had a good enough playing background that they kind of expedited me into what's considered a coach two level. So in Canada, it goes by like you're an instructor, then you're a level one, level two, level three, level four. And I think there's like very few people who are level five. So I think to get an instructor is not very long. It might be a weekend course, but, so my level two course, which is considered, they kind of different phases. So level two is considered the fundamental stage of teaching. And that course was long. We had six regroupings. And each regrouping was at least, for 4 days, and each day was 8 to 5. So the full day. And, we would regroup with six times within like a year and a half. You know, that was, so to get that, that's what you have to do. That was the minimum. Now, Tennis Canada would pay. So like, I had some buddies who would, from Vancouver who would come, and, you know, Tennis Canada would pay for their flights, but the coaches would have to pay for their stay. So they helped out, but it was a big commitment from people who weren't coming from outside. If you weren't in Toronto, it was a big commitment, right? You're losing pay, and you have to pay for your hotel and whatever for those regroupings.
But the certification, the regroupings were free. You just had to.
No, they were. I think some coaches would get subsidized, but they were not free. You were paying $2,000, wow. I think, at least.
Wow.
And then. You know, the fundamental course, which was what I did, the coach too, was not. I don't think it was very, they never got into the nitty gritty of fundamentals. You know, it was very vague. You know, they talked about setup and, you know, they had their, I think their five characteristics, which were like grip, setup, contact point, follow through, but they never really got deep into those things.
Yeah.
But
no details.
Never really gone into that. No details. It wasn't what I would expect, you know. But one of the things we did do, like to graduate that course, basically the way you graduated that course was you had to pick two students who you were working with at the beginning of the course, and you had to film them. Like the same, you know, you'd have to film from three different angles, 45, side, back. And you film them 18 months, and then 18 months later, you would have to show an improvement through film.
That's cool.
And that's how you graduated that course.
Oh, that's great.
It was done on that. Now, I don't know how strict they were in that, but I did a good job.
I'm sure.
With the word system.
That's kind of how it works.
Yeah. The word system, I know you're a big fan of so many sports. Miron, if a very, very competitive guy, if 2 9-year-olds walk by, he's going to ask him what the score was. I've always thought that was
always fun. Want another score.
With, but like say in ice hockey, I tell people that's part of my background is my older brother. Even before that, my father is a student of hockey. But when you think about, you know, football teams, they want to learn the systems of each and every coach and what people are doing and studying film. But it's amazing where, you know, that's kind of like a bad word in tennis.
Yeah.
To me, system is just an organized plan.
Right.
Peter Burwash used to say, you know, he's a top Canadian. He's done so much for tennis. And he made a major impact on this program we ran for tennis teachers. I have to stop and think. We don't teach form. We teach understanding. And I would tell people, all right, we're going to be very respectful of Peter. And then for a 10-year period, you know, Peter would send his staff and they allowed us to customize an outline that they covered, and they covered from A to Z. So we're not going to teach form. We're going to teach understanding. Then I just said, well, then when he leaves, I'm going to counter that and say, we're going to teach people to understand form. There's far more similarities than there are differences. Let me ask one question. I think that the tennis in Canada for the teaching pro, it's not as commercialized. Would you think that's true? There's not as much hype. The coaches, it's more like a European flavor where this is the club you teach at. And would you agree with that? There's not so much advertising.
Yeah, I think it's probably definitely more than the US, but I just think it's because like, if you don't have a club in the wintertime, you have nowhere to go. Right.
Right.
So yeah. I think in the summertime, like, some coaches will do their own thing and they will kind of separate from their club. But if you don't have a base, then suddenly what you're independent for 4 to 5 months and then come like right now, you know, you're done. So I think you're kind of, you're stuck. You basically have to commit to somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. I refer to that as the car trunk pro. A place like Florida, there's all sorts of car trunk pros. Welby Van Horn used to say that a $5 lesson, of course, it goes back when lessons were $20. The $5 lesson is so expensive because then you have to go back and unlearn and relearn. But I do think professionalism is higher as well in an indoor market. I spent most of my career, you know, here in Florida and in California, Texas. I mean, I've certainly traveled a great deal, but I know the time I have spent in indoor markets, not just to go run a 3-day workshop, but to be there on a regular basis, as you pretty much know what everybody's doing because it's everybody under one roof. What you mentioned earlier too, is it the Veneto Club? What's the name of that club in Woodbridge?
Yeah, Veneto. It's in Woodbridge.
Yeah, where it wasn't this year, it was the year before. I talked about this one player is that in Canada, when someone becomes like Dennis was, you know, a really good 14, 15, 16-year-old, they're playing with men at night because of the distribution of indoor court time. Because as you said, after school, you know, you've got the after schoolers. It's the level of play is much more general, or the word beginnerish, which is not a word. But yeah, it's interesting how the weather, I mean, so everything comes into, you know, how a player gets from A to B. The weather's definitely a factor.
Yeah. One question I had, yeah, Aaron, and maybe, sorry?
No, go ahead, man.
No, I was saying one question I really wanted to ask you is, and maybe it's already been answered with the tournament. I think the way they run their national tournaments with the round robin, I think is a great idea. But what would be maybe one or two other things that you would like to see implemented in other countries that Canada does well, or for us, the U.S.? I mean, I know you've spent some time here in the U.S.
Yeah, like I would, from what I've been told with the U.S., I just feel maybe that of education as not, I don't know, you guys tell me, what's an education system like to get a coaching certification? Like, how does it work? I remember I did my PTR certification down there, and that was a 2-day breeze. So I don't know, what's the education system like?
The USPTA is a couple, like when I did it, it was 2 days, you know, weekend, and then the USTA high performance program was a week, I think 5 days.
Well, I think also too is that when Andy and I know Miran, you've participated when we're running workshops. Years gone by, I did a lot of things with Dennis Vandermeer, for example. Is you'd have the newbies, you have all the newcomers that would be going, you know, the young upcoming neophytes who would be, you know, wanting to become a teaching pro. And the people that have playing backgrounds, it's almost like they bypass that. And, but I think, you know, certification is not education. I think the sad thing in the U.S. is so many people that are teaching are not certified. But yeah, you know, you could flip the question around too, is that what would you like to see done, you know, not only what you're doing in Canada that would help the rest of the tennis. I think Andy mentioned so many, you know, playing more matches and coaches working together and such. But what about what could be done to make Canadian tennis better? Because if you talk to people who live in the country, it's not, you know, it's not all, you know, looking at tennis through rose-colored glasses. So when you ask people what's going on in Canadian tennis, I do think they've done a very good job. I think it's much easier to just draw players from three cities. I think that they've invested in a lot of young upcoming players that have done well. But yeah, to flip that around, what do you think they could do? What could be done better in Canadian tennis?
Well, if we go back to kind of, well, I think firstly, like, yeah, they've done a good job, definitely. But, you know, if you look, I think you'll only know how good we've done a good, and you know, how good of a job we've done if players keep coming. So it's not, you know, sometimes you can say you have done a good job. You have one generation of three or four guys, but, you know, only time will tell if we're going to have more coming. And so that's kind of, but like looking at it is, you know, when I did my certification, I just feel like, you know, it comes back down to I hit the ball better, you know, and being more structured in that, you know. And I think, you know, when I did my internship with you, Steve, and then I came back and I did the level two coach. And for me, it was, I didn't get anything out of it because I just never felt like they really got into how to make somebody hit the ball better. And I think looking at it, it's like, you know, people graduated from that course, and unless a coach has someone that they can learn from, I don't think people graduated that course with a clear understanding of, you know, how to take a beginner, or how to take a good 9-year-old, a young 9-year-old, and, you know, teach him. I think that's something that, you know, I would definitely like to improve.
Yeah, last year you were down here with a group of players that you had at the Eddie Herr, and you worked with some of our players at the Eddie Herr, then you came by our place. It's amazing how many Canadians have taken advantage of the U.S. college system like you did. Is that something that's still, kids, that's what they're pursuing? Want to be able to come to the U.S. to play college tennis?
Yeah, I think it's just more, talked about more now. So I think it's just more open, more people are aware of it. With social media, with everything, people post stuff and, it's advertised more. So I think, and there are a couple people who are kind of doing it as a business. So helping people get scholarships and stuff like that. So definitely more of an option than it was when even I was growing up.
Yeah. Well, we got to wrap it up.
Looking back on coaching, I'm looking at the certification. I did the hours. So, basically the way the coach's certification was done here, it was basically just a grind of like regroupings, and there weren't like, I learned some things, but most of the time you just learn from being around other people and you take whatever you think you like. But I think, the amount of time in these regroupings was 216 total hours to get my level 2, and then another 216 total hours to get my level 3.
Yeah. Wow. That's not happening here.
So so if you want to be a coach, and you want to move up in the coaching ladder, it's not like you have to show that you want to do it.
Yeah.
It's not like they're just going to give you something. Like, you got to earn it at least. Maybe you could earn it with more, but, at least they're putting us through something that's a little bit more time tedious.
Well, the one thing is the USPTA and the PTR, they're obviously international, but they're based here in the U.S., United States Professional Tennis Association, Professional Tennis Registry, but they're not under the governing body of the USTA. Although the USTA, some people say they flex their muscles and, they've got the money, they've got the power. And now they're saying those two organizations have to be accredited by the USTA. But in American tennis, there certainly hasn't been, under one umbrella. Some people, debate and say, well, that's been a good thing that there's been competition and been, three organizations instead of one. But here in the U.S., I think, and I think around the world too, it is too easy to become a tennis teacher. I think you get by so much on personality and being the cheerleader instead of actually being a true technician. But
I know one thing, here that some people find it a nuisance, but I think it's good, is where with the continuing education, where with the different certifications here, you do have to get a certain amount of continuing education credits every 3 years or within 3 years. Do they do anything like that in Canada?
Yeah. You have to take a course once every 2 years to maintain your whatever certification you have.
Right.
But usually they have multiple, outside of the certification classes, they usually do like multiple regroupings.
Okay.
A year where they'll bring a couple coaches in and you'll go and you'll listen and stuff like that.
Cool.
Yeah, I know we have some classes on the computer, some courses that you can get PTR or USPTA credit. Mm. But I do think that it's limited if you're just, you're just on your fingertips, going to the computer versus actually going, like you did. It's interesting that, I'm sure you're born in 84. So I met you before I was there in 95, but I was there 2 years working with you, then worked with you, on a periodic basis after that. But so you were a young kid, but then for you to, after college, come back and go through an internship, most people don't do what you did. Most people, they get to your level of play. And I think that, you downplayed that as far as big lefty serve. I always tell people that Miron should have been a stay-at-home defenseman because of his body type. He should have been a hockey player. But why don't we just end with this story that leads into you having too high opinion of pro tennis, and then you took some kids. I know you took my son, Connor, to some tournaments, but you were at a tournament and said, hey, can I play? Why don't you just, we'll end with that story.
Yeah, well, so like when I was down in Florida, I took Connor to some tournaments and I'm watching the futures. You know, I'm just like, well, these guys, I started coaching and I'm like, you know, these guys aren't that good. So I went to York University to go watch trap at York University, and I was watching these guys play, and in my head I'm like, man, like, these guys aren't that good. Like I can play with these guys. So I go up and I go, hey, I know there's a tournament next week, and how can I put my name in that tournament? And he goes, you know, sign up here and you can get into qualifying. Signed up, and you know, I wasn't training, I wasn't playing, I was coaching, not playing very much. Signed up, went to the qualifying. I ended up winning like two or three matches in qualies. Won my first round match in the main draw, and ended up losing to a guy. His name was Chris Klingman. He went to, I think he played at Ohio State, got to like 300-400 in the world. I lost like 6-4 in the third to him.
Were you in shape?
That was my one pro tournament.
Were you in shape too, or no?
Well, it was like the shape of, because I lost like 35 pounds in our bet that I beat you in when I stayed down there. That was the shape I was in, but I wasn't in shape.
Yeah, our listeners.
I didn't need to do much; it just served.
Our listeners should know. You know, Miron's much, much bigger than I am, and he showed up for his internship. And I said, "Okay, let's have a bet." And he lost 35 pounds at his internship.
It was an unfair bet, Steve, huh? Because you know my percentage of body fat was 25%, and you had very little to lose.
Well, I knew I was going to lose the bet, but I just wanted to lose 35 pounds. But it reminds me of Matt Clore, who you know well. Matt Clore, I think the finances come into it too. I think that's where it's been great that these young Canadians of recent times have had the financial support. But, I mean, I think people do know it's next to impossible funding to be a pro tennis player. But yeah. Matt's wife always says that she wishes that he had met me a little before. I know his father, Ernie, feels strongly. I mean, Matt hits the ball so well. In fact, when I made a video of his strokes, my son said nobody could beat Matt Clore. Matt was my son's assistant coach in college. So it was you and Jeff Lewis that we made this video of Matt, and you guys kept going, who is that guy? Who is that guy? Because he had like next to perfect technique. And he always reminded the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were they're being chased by the whatever, what do you call it? The posse, and the horses are after him, the sheriff. And they kept going, who are those guys? Who are those guys? So you and Jeff Lewis kept saying, who is that guy? Who is that guy? But yeah, you got to believe. I mean, I do think that it's probably a little bit distant to say the win of Daniel Nestor beating Edberg in a 5-set Davis Cup match when Edberg was, I think, one in the world in 1992, that really helped Dennis and Felix. But I do think that that one amazing summer that Jeannie Bouchard had, it's kind of like, if she can do it, I can do it. But it's always fun Bouchard. To talk to you.
Yeah, it was good. It was good talk. Good catching up, guys. And you know, your content is amazing.
Hey, I cut you off. What about Bouchard? People are saying, what happened to Bouchard? I mean, she's not where she was, huh? That must be a Canadian title.
I think she had a little bit of a run at the French. She qualified. But there's another young girl that we didn't even talk about. What was her name? Fernandez, too, huh?
Yeah, she won the French. She 2019.
Yeah, she won French juniors.
But then again, she's an immigrant. I think her father's from Ecuador.
Immigrant and a father is tough. That father is tough from what I've been told.
Yeah.
I was told a story that the father pulled her up the court when her behavior was poor in the 12s. Just, she was acting poorly and the father just gone on the court and took her up. So you're not playing.
You know, that's almost consistent with every kid. I think Jack Kramer, Vic Braden was so close to Jack Kramer. Jack Kramer, the story goes, he was playing Jones and Jones was acting like a jerk. So Jack was acting like a jerk. And so Jack's father went to the umpire and young Jack Kramer was thinking, hey, my father's going to take care of this. And the next thing he knows, the umpire said, game, set, and match to Jones. And he pulled his kid off the court. I know Matt Clore tells a story about his mother pulling him off the court by his ear for poor behavior. You know, yeah. Bjorn Borg was not allowed to go to a tennis club for 6 months. He couldn't play for 6 months.
Yeah.
So when he came back, he was the Iceman.
He was the Iceman.
No, I hope our listeners found some value in this. Miron, it's great to talk to you. We'll follow up and we'll talk to old man Richard.
Miron, thanks so much for being on with us. Appreciate all the stories. It was
fun. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right.
We'll talk again soon.
All right, Miron, all the best.
See ya.
All right, bye.
Bye. Well, it's nice talking to Miron. I really like, you know, the stories with Dennis, Felix. I've been around Felix a little bit, coached against him in a losing effort before, but that's the same thing I noticed about him was just the maturity. You could just tell he was going to do what he needed to be done, stretching and all the stuff. He just handled himself really, really well. You could see that.
Yeah.
Very clearly. I knew he was going to be good.
Yeah, I sum it up with him. I think, mature beyond his years.
Yeah.
I think with Dennis, they were in it for the long run.
Yeah.
So they saw the big picture. It wasn't about, the little 12 and under trophy. Obviously that not that much was said about Bianca, US Open champion. But
Raonic as well. I mean, we didn't really get to him, but
yeah, with Bianca with that they copied Halep. And, they just go with the best.
Yeah.
Raonic, he's right from that Thornhill, Richmond Hill area. He's taught by Casey Curtis. Casey Curtis. who obviously has done a lot of great things with players. I always think about he was in Montreal for a year. Then he went to Spain. And people just need to understand this. So a Spanish coach, should be able to tell you his name, said to him, what are you doing? He's hitting aces. There's a young player that comes from the same club as Miron, Jeremy Langer. I think Jeremy has the record for most matches won at Indiana University. If you saw it, Langer, if you're listening, I mean, he was very talented lefty, just lazy, but so gifted. So out of nowhere, this Raonic starts just hitting bombs, his serve. But Raonic is in Spain. So going back, Langer had his number. So Langer kept saying, I can't return to serve, And Richard Hernandez would say, it's not that good. They all tease Richard about that now. But with Raonic was in Spain and he's trying to hit aces, playing in the futures level. And the coach said, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're here to learn to work the point, learn to rally, play all over the court. You're not here to hit aces. I mean, what are you going to get out of that? It's a futures tournament. So even that mentality, it's not just 12 and under when you get to a futures level. One thing about, what he said about Fernandez, the father, she's tough. Right now, because of the bubble, we just have American kids here. We don't have people coming and going. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how people think I'm tough.
Yeah.
But they don't know because the American culture.
It's just principled.
Yeah, it's principled, but I think what it really comes right down to, there's soft love, tough love, and crazy love. And if you really want to be good, it's crazy love.
Yeah.
It's not about doing what you want to do.
And the kid has to be crazy passionate,
Yeah, no, I think that's obsessed. Where, again, coming back, like a Sampras, I mean, when it comes down to Agassi's father, where, it's not easy to make a new way in a new country, so... I guess I'll just say hungry dog hunts best.
Yeah, like it. All right, everybody, hope you've enjoyed that conversation about Canadian tennis with Miron Mann. We're going to also interview Richard Hernandez in the next few weeks sometime. So it'll be a part two with Canadian tennis. But as always, you can find us at greatbasetennis.com. We've got some free courses there. Find us on social media at greatbasetennis. Hope you've enjoyed it. And until the next one.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Adios.
Amigos.